That was a heartwarming little story, wasn't it?
This is the Extra Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 102. Sarah forces everyone to watch Alfred Hitchcock Presents The Glass Eye. I am Big Dummy David T. Cole, and I'm here with Plummy Accent Sarah D. Bunting.
Ew, hello.
And dried up spinster Tara Ariano.
Don't look at me, I'm in my 30s.
We'll get to it. First, greetings, Patreon supporters. Thank you so much for your backing. We really appreciate it. And to show our gratitude, we got you a time machine. Just kidding, mostly. But today we are talking about an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the anthology series that, in my opinion, does not get nearly as much attention as it should, especially compared to The Twilight Zone. But for whatever reason, that's the one I had way more exposure to growing up. It feels like our local sports team's rain delays aired this instead of Twilight Zone episodes.
Yeah.
If this is also a fond memory for you, dear listener, the whole series is on Peacock. For us to discuss today, I thought we'd go with a Shatner starrer, the third season premiere. It is called The Glass Eye, and it aired October 6th, 1957. Like a lot of these mid-century anthologies, it is a nested story, so we open on Shatner packing up his late cousin's apartment. Said cousin, played by Jessica Tandy, was a spinster with what we might call a fairly narrow world, but she had one very kook balloons thing happen to her when she, quote, was in her 30s. Tee-hee. Tara, do you have any comments?
Hang on. Did I hear the phrase kooks balloon?
Kook balloons. Have you never balloons. Heard Sarah say this before?
Probably, but I'm enjoying it staple. Immensely. Excuse me.
It's in the rotation.
I enjoyed it so much, I'm choking on a cracker 3 minutes ago.
Which makes you perhaps a kook balloon.
I love it.
It can be a noun. It can be an adjective. Kook balloons.
I love it. Okay, sorry.
Equally kook balloons is the fact that we are expected to accept Jessica Tandy, 48 years old during filming, as in her 30s. In this episode, Tara has tweeted about this. Tara, any other comments?
At first, when they show her, Dave was like, that neck is not in its 30s. And I was like, well, she could be 39.
No.
But then he looked her up.
That eye crepe is not in its 30s either.
She looks real old, but she's around our age and she looks rough.
The question is, why did they not just say in
she was in
40s?
Her 40s?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe Jessica Tandy was like, don't say I'm in my 40s.
Sure. Well, who are you fooling, lady? Reason. But okay.
I don't know. Yeah. She's had some hard living, I guess.
I mean, the other thing too is that, like, this was true of my grandmothers who were both born in 1913. Like, women in that period, like, reached middle age at 35 and then just looked 55 for the next 40 years.
Sure.
Like, my grandmother looked old at 42, but then she looked the same kind of old at 72. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing.
This came up on, this happens to men in our age, I think, more often, where it's just like they hit an age and then they just look like that forever. Because this came up when I followed Dickinson creator Elena Smith on Twitter. Uh-huh. She was tweeting back and forth with James Urbaniak, who is in the first episode of season 2 of Dickinson as the ophthalmologist.
But yeah,
has, you know, well-known character actor, voice of Dr. Venture. Uh-huh. And he was saying something about his age, and she was like, wait, what? And he was like, I'm 57. And she was like, what? He said, I'm older than Toby, meaning Toby Huss.
Yeah.
And this like totally blew her mind. And she was like, I think of you as around 42 and Toby as 70. He was like,
yeah,
I think we think of us that way too.
Well, Toby's not on Twitter.
Well, I don't think, who knows? I'm sure he would be like, whatever. I don't think he would care. He seems pretty unvain. But anyway, sidebar.
Yeah. No, that's totally true though. And I mean, it's true of my husband. It was true of my dad, who looked around 52 for 15 years on either side of that.
Sure.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Shatner was 26.
He looks it.
And sorry, looked just like one more. He'd
sorry, just one more thing on the age thing is that when men like are at that stasis level, the thing that changes for them that puts them into the old categories, they start getting Emperor Palpatine eye bags, you know, where they're sort of like red, but see-through at the same time, you know, those things, those are like, oh, you're now officially old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, your shoulders become roughly the same width as your head. Is it sometimes a thing?
Huh.
Trust me. Shatner turning 90 this year.
Wow.
I guess we'll see about that. Anyway, he here looks like he was squeezed out of a tube. Like he's so young and shiny.
He's so smooth. His cheeks, like he just baby ass cheeks on Shatner in this episode.
Yeah, beautiful. And then some extremely Texaco Britishoid theater line deliveries. Here he is sending us into the flashback that makes up most of the episode, clip two.
How could Julia, whose life had been so loveless, possibly have known that when love did come, it might lead to something dangerous and horrifying? Yet there is one small twist in it. One odd and unaccountable thing.
I mean, such a mid-century delivery. This show doesn't seem to be able to commit to where anything is occurring. I mean, Hitchcock is British, doy. Like, I feel like everybody in the show is British and it's supposed to be in London, except when it's in New York. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but there's still that sense that the UK is like classier.
Right.
For these purposes, I didn't have anywhere else to put this note. So here it is now. This was written by Sterling Siliphant, who won an Oscar for In the Heat of the Night. He also wrote many, many, many Naked Cities, the completely overlooked anthology series of the mid-century, and The Poseidon Adventure, and Charlie, and a TV miniseries called Space, and like a bunch of other things. So
didn't he also write Shaft?
Yeah.
Wow, that's quite the portfolio.
Shaft.
That's goddamn right. Once you know that the nested story involves a ventriloquist's dummy combined with the title, you're 80% of the way to guessing what's probably going to happen. But Julia is on her customary weekend outing with a neighbor's borrowed entitled child when she becomes ensorcelled by the ventriloquist routine of one Max Collodi. Before you judge her, number one, it was the 50s. People were much more easily amused/bored back then. And two, I'd become a Collodi stan too if it meant ditching this little fart knocker, Dave, clip three.
Here, Alan, dear. You buy yourself some lemonade or whatever you want. I'll be right back.
You're not going to leave me, are you?
No.
Mommy says I'm never to be left alone.
No, dear. I'll be right there at the other side of the lobby.
Oh, you didn't even cut the worst part of him either. Like that's just a little taste of how annoying he gets.
He's really obnoxious.
When kids are up, I just make my peace with it that they're going to be annoying, whether they're supposed to be annoying or not. But this one really got under my skin, asking for his fucking lemonade over and over again. Like, this was a really good, shitty kid on screen.
Yeah, yes. It's true. That kid is actually George Clooney. Just kidding, it isn't. But I just thought it was funny that so much is made in this story of her, like, basically borrowing this kid so that she can have that maternal familial experience that obviously everybody wanted. And she was deprived of blah, blah, blah. But then he turns out to be such an asshole that it's like, is it worth it? Like,
also, why create this other relationship with this kid? Like, why isn't the kid Shatner? Like, why isn't it he telling it from his perspective of like having known her at the time, you know?
Yeah. Especially if you're going to do like they're apparently trying to do something period with the various hats. But it's like, I'm just not sure why the flashback was required or, you know, why this incident didn't end up killing her from shock. And then you could just leave it in the present day.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Julia becomes a Collodi super fan. They start corresponding.
In my notes, I have Max head.
Max head.
Like a dead head.
Yeah. I mean, because she is following him from town to town. I mean, she's stalking the guy, but it was the 50s. So, of course, this is framed as the consequences of a dusty old virgin going off the rails thanks to not having, you know, regular D and kids like she's, quote, supposed to.
Yeah. Well, it's the 50s talking about the, you know, the tens based on her costuming, I think. Right.
She's granted an audience at last with Kaloti, and the invitation comes with a lot of super crimson flaggy prereqs, but of course she blows right past those because she's in love. And wants to get some of that good wood. Sorry. So she visits him in his hotel room, only to find that the dummy, played by the great Billy Barty, spoiler, is pulling the strings using Kaloti's human body, or a non-little person-sized dummy. I was unclear, thanks to the era's, quote, special effects, whether we're supposed to conclude Kaloti is a corpse or a dummy. Thoughts?
I don't think it matters.
Okay, so this is how
I mean, it doesn't.
Okay, so the storyline roughly goes, she watches this act. It is a mustachioed gentleman operating a small ventriloquist dummy. And it's also funny.
Which barely moves its mouth, by the way, which bothered me so much.
Yeah. And then when she finally meets him, finally gets to meet him in person after months or years or something of following him around Europe, Deadhead style. They meet, and it turns out that the human is in fact what she thought was the dummy, and the dummy is the human. That there's a little person operating a giant ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah,
right.
He has like a paper mache head on that he wears to look like a puppet.
And then at the end, there's a, you know, sort of a horror break, and the dummy falls, and she falls, and at some point during that, she picks up the dummy's glass eye, right? But at the end of it, when Hitchcock comes back, he says, oh, this wasn't really a glass eye at all, which says, like, oh, the horror of it is he actually had a real eye in his little ring case this whole time, which means then they were both real. Like, I don't really know.
I just thought that was Hitchcock saying, like, it's not glass, it's plaster or something.
Oh, no, I thought
I thought it was Hitchcock being like, oh, this is a real eye. Well, see you next week. And then he pieces off screen.
Whether that was just like, well, here's another additional moment of weirdness from Alfred Hitchcock, but then it like reverses everything that happened in the story, or at least the dummy part of it.
Well,
so if you take that Billy Barty is the ventriloquist and he had a dummy, right? And then by the glass eye bit at the end means the dummy was actually human. There was two humans and one, like, is very confused by the ending with Hitchcock.
I mean, in the end, like, why is the glass eye the catalyst for this? Like, this is an okay story. Like, they do it, like, given that it's 1957, they do it with the effects that they can. And it's like, you know, mostly you're watching for the famous people, but also, like, some of these can still be really creepy. It's like a, you know, any old Twilight Zone episode that you're sort of like, oh, that worked, or Naked City, whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, the glass eye, I mean, like, they're streaking, she leaves, Shatner explains that she somehow, quote, picked up the glass eye that rolled out of someone's head, and then Shatner wraps it up with a coda about Kaloti disappearing, and then a faraway circus turns up a sad, very short clown, and then we see Billy Barty with an eye patch, and he gives the camera a knowing half look, and the eye patch is fitted incorrectly. And then Hitchcock is like, oh, well, I have this real eye. Ha ha, aren't I kooky? And then he leaves. And I don't think that has to do with the story. So
I don't think so either. I think the coda with Hitchcock is just like, I have a real eye because I'm Alfred Hitchcock and I'm weird. I don't think it necessarily.
Yeah, I agree.
Has anything to do with the eyes.
But
the story.
Here's
well, let Sarah finish.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But in the actual story, it's like, why did the glass eye really has nothing to do with why this story is sad or disturbing.
Right.
And it makes no sense that she would have, like, what, it got caught in her voluminous virgin skirt? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a bad episode, but then at the end, you're like, wait,
what?
Like, why is the eye here? Why is Shatner here? When are we?
Right.
There's some problems.
I'll just say, like, before we throw it back to Dave, the eye thing seems to me like it's like in being in a creative writing class and they're like, your title is The Glass Eye, write a story.
I would not be surprised.
They had an idea about a crazy ventriloquist dummy, and then like they were like, oh fuck, I forgot about the glass eye part, and then they had to like wedge it back in.
Probably.
You know, because it does feel so tacked on, as it were.
I mean, he has one more Oscar than we do, but still.
Okay, so this might be putting a kind of a modern like super twist reveal,
sure,
you know, kind of thing on it. But let's just cut Hitchcock out of the picture. So the end of the episode, the human-sized dummy falls down. She grabs that eye, and then the last scene of the story is the actual human with an eye patch, like the little person. So is this actually? And keep in mind, Shatner is telling the story. So Tandy is an unreliable narrator. And what happened was she was a stalker and she met this guy, ripped out his eye.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And then later sort of, you know, justified it, rewrote the story so she wasn't the monster. And this is like this weird, impossible story about, you know, the roles being reversed in this act, whereas she was just super into this person. She felt betrayed for whatever reason that he was posing as the dummy instead of the ventriloquist. And then she did something horrible to him.
Right.
And ended his career.
Right.
Sure. I mean, given the other holes in the story, I see no reason why that can't be slotted to fit in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just feel like there was a story that was, oh, they're actually the roles are reversed. End of story. Easiest interpretation, right?
Right.
Yeah. The dummy was a ventriloquist. A ventriloquist was the dummy. And then somebody thought, well, let's just throw some more question marks into the story and not think about what they mean to the story. Eye patch on little person in the coda.
Yeah.
And then Hitchcock in the coda's coda. Like those two things confuse if you try to figure out logically, which is why I back up to the unreliable narrator one, because at least that one has an ending, right? With the narrator story.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't also add that Collodi is the name of the guy who wrote Pinocchio. Mm. Carlo Collodi.
I see.
You know, the boy that came to life.
Can we talk about the DIY transition between present day Shatner and the backstory, which is they're holding up a piece of plastic that's usually for like patio doors.
A piece of the
The
pebbly plastic.
I was gonna say shower doors, but
Shower doors. Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. Shower doors. You're right. Shower doors from like the 80s, that style. Obviously, this is from earlier, but they hold it up to the camera and they go closer to the camera with this piece of shower glass so that it becomes more and more diffused as it goes. And then they pull it back and then try to do an actual transition between you know, between that still and then one shot without the glass at all in the shot. And it doesn't really work. And the first time you see it, it's super confusing because the transition with Shatner really is clumsy. And I didn't realize that this was just supposed to be a dream-esque dissolve.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know what was going on. It was like somebody was like trying to be a little too fancy with her.
Yeah.
I'd also like to talk about the fact that this spinst with her Clark's job at a solicitor who kept records using the moist paper method, which I am not looking up because ew, has like this giant apartment. Like I just kept pausing it and looking at the black and white decor porn in the background, like all these armchairs clearly covered in velvet. And I'm like, does this solicitor need any help? Because that seems to pay pretty well. And then she was able to retire and follow Collodi around for a year.
Right. Yeah. That was more space than you would think someone at that time living alone would strictly require.
Right.
Even someone who you would think, you would guess like maybe she came from some kind of gentility and had fallen on hard times or whatever. Like maybe she had some inheritance or something.
Newsflash.
Yes.
Moist paper method is basically ditto machines.
Oh.
Yeah. I just kept they're showing her at her dinner table.
Yeah.
And then in the back of the shot, there's all this space and there's like two separate seating areas. Like apparently she lives in a hotel lobby.
Yeah.
And Shatner has been narrating like often she would fix herself a slice of ham. And I'm like, pressed ham? Like there was really a lot of narration about her like cooking habits on a single flame.
Mm-hmm.
But then she's sitting under a pin light, lonely and virginal and childless. And the voiceover is going on and on about like her life and its loneliness. And I'm like, this is a huge apartment in, I think we're supposed to think, London.
Yeah, they say they go to Fulham to the music hall.
Yeah. She yeah. goes to, like, she goes to bed at 10 and is reading, like, Lives of the Authors. I'm like, this is supposed to be horrible?
Yeah. Yes, Sarah. It's unsatisfying. She's alone.
Retired spinst who has literally five couches in her home. I'm not seeing why it's so sad, but I also wouldn't... I wouldn't go on tour with a ventriloquist dummy saying I needed a miracle either, so... But I mean, I didn't... Like, this is not great. It's weird and weirdly constructed, but I didn't mind it. I got sort of strong A Rose for Emily vibes from it, and even though that didn't end up paying off, I thought it was okay. I hope I am not universally despised for making you guys watch this.
No, I thought the main problem with the episode, beyond its sort of like, you know, look in the mirror and take two things off ending, was that, like Twilight Zone, often the stories are all hinged on just one piece of information, right? In this case, it is the dummy and the ventriloquist were actually flipped.
Right.
Leading up to that, you have to have like an escalation of whatever the mood is. And it doesn't do that in this episode. She is just as kind of crazy and sad at minute three as she is at minute 19 before the reveal. Like, there's not an escalation of, like, beyond the fact that she goes to follow him on tour, which isn't shown, it's just dealt with in Shatner dialogue. That was like why this didn't work as like kind of a piece of horror, right? Which I think it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
It didn't up the stakes as it went along. It just felt like you were surfing until the end. And that was, that's the problem with this episode.
Well, and the other problem is that, I mean, as also as with so many Twilight Zone episodes, and this was the same thing we said when we watched the revival, is like, If the whole thing is like, there's a twist, and as soon as the premise is set out, you're like, okay, so the twist is going to be X, and then you know what it is. It's like, make this a 12-minute show, you know? Like, we have the technology. I mean, they couldn't do this then, obviously, but, like, that's something they could do with the Twilight Zone now. And in terms of the escalation, part of the problem is because of the time. They couldn't really get into making her, like, not just escalating her craziness because it would upset people. Like, this was a period of time where, like, you couldn't show, you know, Marion Crane's blood in the tub where in Psycho, because whatever.
Right.
Like, there's only so far you can go with that, and it's, you know, even less far on TV, even less than that that you can go with, like, the horniness, which is like a key element of this. And so, you know, if we're not being privy to the letters that she's writing him, you know, you want this to be like the song Stan, the Eminem song, where she's like writing increasingly unhinged letters to Kolodi.
Yeah.
Where she's like, I'm going to kill myself if I don't get to fuck you or something.
Like, and Shatner, like, and his wife at the end are cleaning it out, and they go to the armoire, and there's a tiny little person skeleton in there. Like, oh my God, that's the extra thing. Yes. You know what I mean? Like, there's something there that isn't escalated that needs to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're supposed to take much more or infer much more from her, like, sad, shitty, dickless, kidless existence. And here in 2021, it's like, what, like, as we've just been saying, like, you got a bunch of couches and a bunch of books. What's the problem?
Right. Yeah.
The only thing your life needs is more TV, frankly, and maybe not this episode. Has either of you seen the Twilight Zone episode called The Dummy that apparently nods to this episode? I feel like I must have seen it, but
no.
I don't rings a bell, it. But I can't place it. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. And I mean, there's a Buffy episode with this. Like, here's the thing. It's like when my mother made us rent Citizen Kane, and my brother and I were like, oh, focus pull, big whoop. And my mom's like, he fucking invented that and a bunch of other tricks. That it's like, okay, but we saw the other tricks already.
Yeah.
This probably was like, ooh, at the time, but it's not 1957 anymore. And thank God.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that Twilight Zone starred Cliff Robertson.
Oh,
yeah, I think that's a pretty famous one, actually.
Yeah. That does sound familiar now that you mention it. Yeah.
I won't make you watch that one.
You can. That should be your next one.
Yeah, listeners, tell me what to do.
Was there a revival of Alfred Hitchcock Presents in the 80s or something? There was. I am not imagining that. Okay, good.
Yeah,
he also had a book series that was really creepy. A couple of those kept me up nights for sure when I was a tween.
Yep, I remember getting those from the library.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100%. I'm, we're not, no one's mad at you for making us. Sarah.
You're just disappointed.
No, not disappointed either. Like, it's always interesting to revisit, like, what TV was like in the olden times. Because, like, I never watched old TV like this.
What was that movie about? It was like Hysteria. Is that the movie about? It was about the guy who creates the vibrator. You remember that?
Oh, that. Right. Yeah. Yes. It Hysteria? Was called Hysteria. Yeah. With Claire Danes' husband.
Thank you.
Yes.
So the movie Hysteria. This feels like this would have been like what they're filming and not really getting into while that movie, you know what I mean? This would be like a catalyst for discussion in that movie somehow, although the time periods don't run.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's clear, like, you know, female sexual desire and female thwarted ambition and, like, female, you know, completely happy solitude are all dangerous in different ways. And it's like, what do you want me to do? Like, you know, all of that part of it is always interesting where it's like, you know, you can't win. This is life in patriarchy.
Also, to Hitchcock's, not credit, but... whatever. In context, when you look at later Hitchcock films where he is allowed to be much more open and like gory and direct about matters of sexual sadism, like Frenzy. Mm-hmm. Frenzy is like inadvertently hilarious when it should be really disturbing. And it's because he's allowed to just say the thing out loud. And it's like, I don't think that's, you know. This guy's been doing it for 30 years by this time. So
yeah, he needs the Hays Code.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
What are you going to do now?
Well, first I'm going to try licking myself, and then I'm going to catch my killer.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 122. Dave forces everyone to watch the failed 1990 pilot of Puchinsky. I am the Heat, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Donut Joke, Sarah DiBunting.
Fritter? I hardly know her.
And Merry Widow, Tara Ariano.
Oh, I'd love to marry a cop.
Welcome back to Extra, Extra Hot Great. Thank you to all our supporters for making this possible and keeping the lights on here at Extra Hot Great. Today's episode involves me forcing Tara and Sarah to watch the 1990, feels like it should have been further back than that, failed pilot of Puchinsky. Now, you may have heard of this. This is one of the more famous, what the hell were they thinking, pilot concepts in which... get this. Peter Boyle, you know him from Young Frankenstein and the dad from Everybody Loves Raymond, plays Stanley Puchinsky, who has a very convenient last name because in the course of events of the pilot, he will die and then possess the body of a dog. Mm-hmm. According to Wikipedia, with their dry sensibilities, this is what Puchinsky is all about. The story follows a New York police detective, Peter Boyle, whose spirit is transferred into a flatulent English bulldog after he is killed in the line of duty. The canine detective then returns to solving crimes. Okay, so who else is in this show? As his new partner, who's really not getting along with him, George Newbern.
Yeah!
As Detective Robert McKay.
He is
McKay.
One to watch. Woo!
George Newbern, the recent subject of a Listen to Sassy segment in which back in 1988, he was determined to be one to watch.
Yep.
And while he's still a working actor, I say that he wasn't exactly one to watch in the spirit of one to watch.
Yeah, I'll call the hotline and say he's more one to watchable than some.
Because so far, the one to watches before George Newbern have been particularly who? So he is so far the watchiest, but I would say he is not reaching the level of one to watch. Anyways, he plays the sort of rookie-ish detective who gets roped into this whole affair. And rounding out the cast, we got Amy Yazbeck as the Merry Widow living in his apartment building.
Mrs. John Ritter.
Yeah.
Captain Ed Martin, played by Frank McRae, also plays the captain in Last Action Hero, playing the same role.
And just died like 2 weeks ago.
We miss him.
Yeah, we lost him.
And the only other one billed is Brian Haley, who plays this other sergeant. And just imagine like a little more put together Gary Busey. And that's what this guy looks like.
This character's name is Sergeant Shriver.
Yeah,
not
it is.
For nothing.
Mm-hmm. I was not impressed by that either. But he was also a stand-up. He had like his thing was he had a flat top. Him and Drew Carey, that was their hook, I guess.
So NBC somehow, for some reason, passed on this pilot, but in fact did end up airing it to fill some dead space, I'm going to guess, somewhere in a dusty Saturday afternoon. But here we are. It is a situation comedy shot like a drama.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on set. It's not live in front of a studio audience.
Yes, it's a single cam.
The pilot gets pretty dark. All things considered, Peter Boyle does get murdered. They don't really explain why he gets transferred into the body of a dog. They just stare at each other for a long time, mm-hmm. and the camera gets closer and closer to the eyeballs, and then Peter Boyle becomes a dog. I feel like if this show somehow made the air today, there would be like episode 9 or so would be like the crazy sorceress filled backstory about how they actually managed to create this magical transfer.
Yes.
But we don't get that here. It's just like, just deal with it. Guy's in a dog. Question I have is, what happened to the dog?
Well, yeah. I mean, what happens is he takes over the dog's body after they have this moment. But before that, Peter Boyle like saves the dog from being hit by a car. So this is his reward. The dog loses its own consciousness, such as it is.
Yeah, there seems to be two possibilities here.
Right.
One, he just gets pushed out. No more dog.
Right.
Two, they actually did do a Freaky Friday and he switched just before he died, which is even darker.
Right.
Yeah.
Because this is the second time that he'd saved the dog. So maybe the universe was like, you're out of chances, hound.
Right.
Because Peter Boyle saved him from the dog from being like tortured by some street urchins, which which he does by threatening them with a gun.
Yeah.
It didn't not get me on the show side.
He's basically a Walter Matthau grumpy old man character, except he has a license to carry a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses that to swing around kids in an alley just for shits and grins.
Yeah. I will say this for the central Peter Boyle in a dog premise. What I appreciate is that when he shows up at his own sparsely attended funeral and McKay, the George Newbern character, is there and Puchinsky starts talking to him and like within the course of a scene, like pretty early on in the scene, in fact, McKay is like, yeah, all right. Like we don't have to also go through the whole rigmarole of like, this can't be, I won't believe it. And Puchinsky having to like prove it to him 50
that.
Times.
I also appreciated that, I mean, there was plenty of fart humor. Mm-hmm. It could have been done better. Perhaps this is why it didn't get picked up. That's not why. There was also a Abram Zucker, partner incompatibility. What is it? It's a big building with doctors and patients.
Right.
Style of joke where
yes.
he's like explaining the phrase he just said. And the lieutenant's like, no, I mean, what's your problem with Puchinsky? And Newbern has to be like, well, he stinks and is Puchinsky, but basically he's like Dr. House in cop form mixed with Matthau. But it's like, we have to put up with this and the dog because he cracks cases. And
yeah,
I was expecting this to be such a disaster. And there were like a number of things that I was like, I mean, I'm all set. I never need to watch it again. But this wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. It was as bad as I thought it would be.
Oh, okay. I mean, I thought it was really going to be bad. I also think I maybe thought it was a musical. And when it wasn't, I was like, ooh, at least they didn't do that.
They took one thing off. Yeah, exactly.
But I think the main problem is Puchinsky. He is not charming as a lovable gruff, and he is not charming in any other way. Like, he's a dick. Like,
yeah.
Listen to this clip.
You're a dog.
What's wrong with being a dog? You got stronger teeth? You can take a nap anytime you want? You see a girl you like, you don't have to bother with small talk.
Lots of stuff like that in the show. And I feel like if Puchinsky actually was a character you can get behind while still being kind of the old man of the show, it would have worked much better. But they didn't go that route. And you just don't know why you should be happy the dog's there. And the dog is terrifying to look at.
Well, let's talk about that. This is a Jim Henson creation, which I discovered a while ago when our past and future main show guest Adam Grossworth and I were texting about something or other. In fact, we were texting about all the weird pilots that came out in 1990, something we covered in the Shangri-La Plaza episode. But there was like this, Cop Rock, Hull High was 1990 as well. Mm-hmm. Like something was happening. Something was cocaine. So when I watched the trailer for Puchinsky before sending it to Adam, I looked it up to see. And yes, this was a creation of the Jim Henson Creature Shop. Maybe that they farmed out to an intern.
There's kind of no way to do it that looks realistic and not creepy. So this is also, it was 1990. This is what you get.
The problem is, like, up until his neck, it's just a dog. It looks fine. And then when they go to move his head, just the way his head moves, you can see through imaginary x-ray vision the hand in his skull moving, because you can see it is a human hand in there, and it makes it so fucking creepy.
Well, I also don't know why it looks cross-eyed all the time. Like, it seems like eye placement on a puppet is a solved issue at the old creature shop, but apparently not.
I think part of the problem is they tried to make his eyes, they didn't make his eyes purely dog eyes. Uh-huh. They were trying to, like, give him a human sort of look.
Like the Shaggy DA or whatever.
Kind of, yeah. And his, like, his irises, sclera, just wasn't big enough.
Yes, yeah.
And it was too much white for a dog because, you know, unless your dog is looking up at the ceiling, you don't see any white. But this was lots of white. It was just like Dr. Moreau'sville. Are you my father?
Yeah.
Like, the character is sexually harassing someone, like, in under a minute of runtime, and then that does not cease when he's a dog, but haha, he's a dog.
Yeah.
Huh?
And Tara, do you want to talk about the Merry Widow?
Oh, just that she certainly has bad hearing. I mean, I would like to know if her husband died because he
he got stuck in the garbage disposal, was screaming for like 50 minutes as it slowly chewed him down. She's in the next room, just knitting or whatever she's doing in 1990.
Yeah, but it's one of those sitcom things where it's like, I mean, first of all, it's the TV thing where someone is 3 feet away and can't hear what's happening directly next to them. But in addition to that, she's like totally unfazed by how squirrely McKay is acting, George Newbern, because he's brought Puchinsky home and Puchinsky is Puchinskying around while she's stopped by to like try and make him dinner or whatever. That part was almost worse than all of the dog stuff. It's just like, this is so corny. We've already been through this 5 billion times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Puchinsky, not good. I would say if you don't want to watch it, and why would you, sort of imagine Shaggy D.A., 48 Hours.
Right.
Naked Gun style comedy.
Turner and Puchinsky. Yeah.
It does not mix. But I kind of am amazed it got onto camera.
Yeah.
So good for them.
1990.
John Ritter, executive producer, he had the juice.
Yeah.
We miss him.
That feels about the right amount of talk about Puchinsky.
I can see you sincerely want your children back, but you have a lot to learn about being parents. Before I can return your children, you'll have to complete a course called Family Skills. It teaches parents to listen to their...
Communication, gotcha.
But it's important to...
Listen, yes, I know.
But there's more to it than...
I have listening skills!
Mr. Simpson, would you please...
Shut up, Judge!
This is the Extra Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 131. Hey, you, shut up. I am, it's 3 a.m., time to take the party inside, David T. Cole. And I'm here with Honking Won't Turn the Light Green, dickhead, Sarah D. Bunting.
Shut up!
And Murray, you don't even know what you're barking at, Tara Ariano.
Gordon's down the hall, you can't even see him!
Shut up, the ABC, whoa, whoa, oh, audio logo.
Shut up, the Hallmark Channel's Christmas in July.
Shut up, Julie's Guitar and Felicity.
Shut up, Amazon Prime Video UI.
Shut up, Pete Davidson.
Shut up, Mariska Hargitay's ill-fitting foundation garments.
Shut up being forced at gunpoint to name all the Discovery-branded cable channels.
Shut up, TV recap podcasts hosted by stars of the TV show in question.
Shut up, Toyota Jan.
Shut up, Buck from 911.
Shut up, The Simpsons and the wrong aspect ratio on Disney+.
Shut up, whoever is refusing to teach Keith Hernandez to use the cough button.
Shut up, burning Agent Carter on ABC before the creation of Disney Plus Marvel shows.
Shut up, SD channels that play in the wrong aspect ratio.
Shut up, drone shots of water towers, a true crime docuseries.
Shut up, characters not saying thank you to the street hot dog vendor.
Shut up, TVs that don't let you correct bad aspect ratios manually.
Shut up, make it rain.
Shut up, contemporary dramas with fictional countries.
Shut up, motion smoothing.
Shut up, Bravo Liberties, word and deed.
Shut up, courtroom confessions.
Shut up, cable subscriptions moving channels around.
Shut up, quote, talking pets and babies in commercials.
Shut up, cowardice of anonymous, quote, leading brands.
Shut up, cable providers telling you to help them work out their carrier disputes with networks.
Shut up, John Hamm's weirdly snotty Mercedes voiceover.
Shut up, that Deadwood movie.
Shut up, Chris from the last season of Married at First Sight.
Shut up, Oxygen's cutesy theme weeks.
Shut up, the death of weird late-night local programming.
Shut up, Chris Harrison.
Shut up, documentaries still using footage of Matt Lauer in newsbreak montages.
Shut up, discovering animation cell versus background painting spoilers as a child.
Shut up, books by bachelor people that never tell you as much as you want.
Shut up, Robert Reed's perm.
Shut up, the ease with how my brain substitutes Gentleman Jack for the line, give me a break in the Kit Kat jingle.
Shut up, bad replacement music on old shows.
Shut up, characters putting their shoes on furniture.
Shut up, end credit fonts that don't match opening credit fonts.
Shut up, the Showtime app I need to log into multiple times a month.
Shut up, the staircase casting news.
Shut up, failure to create a US-Canada version of The Bridge.
Shut up, Supernatural, with your 4,000 seasons when we only got one of Katie Keene.
Shut up, Max Grevy.
Shut up, FBI local cop jurisdiction beefs.
Shut up, most of the teen dads on Teen Mom.
Shut up, Logan Eccles' death.
Shut up, fishing shows that signal the end of the Saturday morning cartoon run.
Shut up, Jeff Probst.
Shut up, Lost finale.
Shut up, Good Wife, Schoolhouse Rock.
Shut up, Dr. Oz.
Shut up, men grabbing women's arms during heated conversations on dramas and soaps.
Shut up, HBO's letter-only user avatars.
Shut up, Dr. Phil.
Shut up, Dylan Howard.
Shut up, Henry Jennings.
Shut up, Dan Harmon.
Shut up, saying you feel like a third wheel. You don't. It's fifth.
Shut up, intrusive thoughts about how Thomas the Tank Engine wipes himself.
Shut up, Wendy Pepper.
Shut up, cities that are or trying to be characters.
Shut up, the world's loudest recorded sound, the Netflix Ba-Dum.
Shut up, Kristen Bell.
Shut up, season two of Friday Night Lights.
Shut up, Lupin's weird giant face chair.
Shut up, Seth MacFarlane.
Shut up, space!
Shut up, magically re-enabling subtitles of Apple TV.
Shut up, Joss Whedon.
Shut up, celery tops sticking out of grocery bags.
Shut up, Mr. Bates.
Shut up, Billy Campbell, character, not actor.
Shut up. Wait, don't shut up, people who hang up without saying goodbye.
Shut up, Netflix not offering enough middling action films with one A-list star for every weekend of the year.
Shut up, Rory Gilmore.
Shut up, fake TV Cape Cod.
Shut up, networks not brave enough to buy my pitch for a Sopranos remake with all the characters in Masked Singer costumes.
Shut up, the Falcon, and double shut up, the Winter Soldier.
Shut up, contestants on The Challenge who talk about honor.
Shut up, the other networks not brave enough to buy my other pitch for a superhero team consisting of the world's greatest cryptozoologic legends like Bigfoot and Ogopogo.
Shut up, Starz content that is not on the Starz app.
Shut up, Verite prestige show vomit.
Shut up, new Magnum.
Shut up, Pooch Perfect.
Sorry, Rex, my littlest buddy, but shut up, mechanized TV preemies.
Shut up, Patrick Melrose.
Shut up, the celebrity dating game.
Shut up, Kit, you buzzkill.
Shut up, Pete Campbell haters.
Shut up, actors hosting game shows hosts should be hosting.
Shut up, timey-wimey.
Shut up, the show, Picard.
Shut up, Jenna Lyons.
Shut up, 17-hour awards telecasts.
Shut up, puzzle-first scripts.
Shut up, Bethany Frankel.
Shut up, amateurs, local ads featuring business owners' non-cute offspring.
Shut up, Rick and Morty fans.
Shut up, Mark Cuban.
Shut up, bullshit, get to know you dead time on game shows. Nobody cares.
Shut up, Ricky Gervais after extras.
Shut up, live sports time slot overruns.
Shut up, Carrie Bradshaw's having of a career.
Shut up, semi-retired British sleuth.
Shut up, Tiger King.
Shut up, all 28 of Stabler's children.
Shut up, the SEO-friendly spelling of Siffy.
Shut up, Michael Weatherly.
Shut up, flash-forward opening scenes.
Shut up, sports delays causing truncated DVR recordings of Amazing Race seasons 1-6.
Shut up, June Osborne, character not American Bishop.
Shut up, characters going to bed in full makeup.
Shut up, Star Trek Discovery, the show, not the American Bishop.
Shut up, Liam on Dynasty. This one's for me only.
Oh, shut up, Roadrunner.
Shut up, that new Star Wars shiny helmets ID thing on Disney Plus.
Shut up, streaming services that load the next episode almost immediately.
Shut up, second seasons of alleged limited series.
Shut up, all Stephen Curry segments on Holy Moly.
Shut up, streaming services that don't wait until you're between episodes to ask if you're still watching.
Shut up, Dan Abrams.
Shut up, the 37% of Black Mirror episodes that are in fact the same story.
Shut up, YouTube rips of very old programming that don't include the commercials.
Shut up, overused The Office GIFs.
Shut up, true title of These Things I Believe.
Shut up, commercials that make you snacky late at night.
Shut up, pathetic fallacy.
Shut up, 2 a.m. recall of the tinkly piano bits from the Succession theme.
He's already been told to shut up, but it's worth repeating. Shut up, Buck on 911.
Shut up, creepily over-invested brother-sister relationships that better have been written by only children.
Shut up, TV shows using shitty, cheap, slow, jangly versions of hit songs.
Shut up, NCIS's.
Shut up, Valentine's episodes.
Shut up, whoever canceled the energy market Dracula blah.
Shut up, Jamila Jamil.
Shut up, phrases like that's bull.
Shut up, X-Files revival.
Shut up, heels living while glow remains dead.
Shut up, cozy British murder mysteries that have apparently depopulated the entire country.
Shut up, X hours earlier.
Shut up, the WandaVision finale.
Shut up, TV drivers who don't watch the road.
Shut up, zombie Futurama seasons.
Shut up, Brandon Walsh.
Shut up, generic beers.
Shut up, Zoom episodes.
Shut up, Deborah Messing.
Shut up, Walt.
That actually broke the Zoom audio feed to our end.
Did it? Sorry. Yeah.
No, fine.
Shut up, Zoom audio feed.